And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Patty C. from San Diego.
Hi, my name is Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor told me to not bend over and talk in the microphone, so. Okay, can y'all hear me? No? Hello? Okay. Oh. Wow. I brought some notes up here because Mike, I enjoyed your share, and I can totally relate. Your word, petrified, I can relate to that right now. I've only done this once before, and the last time I did it, there was about 10 people in the room. So I want to thank you in advance for your patience and for your tolerance with me as I go through this. What it was like, I guess, let's see, I just turned 5. My sobriety birth date is May 16, 2005. My home group is the Mission Hills Lunch Bunch. It's a noon meeting. It's also now weekend meetings, as more fondly referred to by the people that go there as the Huddle, which is the name of the diner that it's located in. I think of the Huddle as sort of my place. It's my place of rebirth, actually. I'm from Texas. Yeah. I was born in Corpus Christi, and I was raised in a small town called Dickinson, which is in Galveston County near Galveston Island. So pretty much my upbringing was all around the Texas Gulf Coast. All of my family is still in Texas. I have two brothers, older brothers, and a sister, and they're all still there. My mom and dad are no longer here with us. What can I say? The first time I drank was 13 years old. I snuck out of the house. I had a girlfriend who had gotten this guy to buy 2 bottles of Boone's Farm Tickled Pink strawberry wine. Yeah. And so we had 1 bottle each. And the goal was to get wasted. And that's what we did. What I remember about that night was, sneaking out in the middle of the night, 13 years old, running around the neighborhood, drinking the whole bottle, puking my guts up, falling down, getting all skin up, bruised, cut, and crawling back in, and then waking up the next morning and feeling horrible and thinking, I can't wait to do that again. I know now from my journey in recovery that I was an alcoholic as soon as I took my first drink. I loved the way alcohol made me feel. I loved to drink. I was shy. But alcohol, helped me come out of my shell. It helped me feel connected. It helped me be social. It helped me feel a part of. And, from the moment I started drinking as a teenager, I was really a liar, cheat, and thief. Everything out of my mouth as a teenager to my parents was a lie. I would tell them I was going somewhere, and I was always doing something different. I remember when, in a small town, there wasn't much places or things to do. And so as soon as some of us got old enough to drive, that was what, You know, we'd all pile in a car, we'd drive around. You know, in Texas, open liquor containers were legal. Of course, underage drinking wasn't. But, you know, we'd ride around. That's all we did. We'd cruise around and drink beer. And we'd sit by the Bayou Bridge for hours and drink beer. And I just remember, you know, stealing money out of my mother's purse. When I was 15, 16, I had a fake ID, and I was going into Galveston and Houston, piling girls into cars, and we were going into clubs, discos, honky-tonks. We were very young, and we were hitting the bars with fake IDs and partying, dancing. We loved to dance, whether it was, you know, the dancing queen on the disco floor or, you know, or the bullshit Cotton Eye Joe. We were out there. And, you know, my brothers and sisters were older than me, so many of them, they were pretty much gone when all this was going on. I kind of was like an only child growing up. But I do recall my sister getting very angry because she said, "You spoiled brat, you get away with everything." I think my parents were tired when the fourth child came along, you know, so I think there was some, you know, more leniency with me, but it just seemed like that I did a lot of things and never got caught. I remember one, I had my driver's license, and I remember telling my mother I wanted to borrow the Oldsmobile, the family car, so I could take some of my girlfriends to a party that was going to be in town. And she agreed and allowed me to. And so I got all the girls, and we didn't go to a party in town. We went to a honky-tonk. I remember the next morning my mother waking me up and calling me into breakfast, and she said, "So how was the party?" And I said, "Oh, it was so much fun." She said, "Well, who was all there?" And so, you know, on and on. I'm going into this fabrication of this party that I didn't go to, these people that weren't even there, what we did, how we played cards, and all this stuff. She was getting madder and madder and madder and madder. And she said, and she just started screaming. She said, "That's it. You're never taking the car again till you go get that bumper sticker off the back of my car." And I was in shock. I didn't know what she was talking about. I looked out the window, and there on the back of the car was a bumper sticker: "I rode the bull at Mickey Gillies." I got busted. I got caught. But you know that whatever the grounding or whatever the punishment was, it didn't last long. I sweet talked them back into letting me use the car again, and I would never go there again and never do that again. And it was just lie, lie, lie. And I remember the getting graduating from high school and my mother letting me have my first glass of champagne. You know, and there's this picture, and I'm thinking, if they only knew, you know. And then I went to college. I went to college at Southwest Texas State University, which is in San Marcos, Texas, and it's now called Texas State. It's about 30 minutes from Austin, Texas. And here is where my life began. It was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'll never forget the first party that I went to. It was a frat party, and I didn't like fraternities or sororities. I wasn't a part of that, and actually I went through Rush, and they didn't want me, and so I had a big resentment towards them. But we liked to go to their parties. And I remember walking into the very first party in college and seeing a guy run by me with a woman's bra on his head. And I thought, oh wow, you know, I have arrived. They asked us if we wanted some Thunder Punch, which was Kool-Aid laced with Everclear, and I was off and running in my college drinking days. Really where I went to school was beautiful. Texas, the Texas Hill Country has a lot of rolling hills, freshwater rivers and lakes. It was absolutely gorgeous. But it was a party school. And, I had very, very good memories from school, a lot of friends. You know, drinking worked for me for a really long time, and I worked in high school and college. There was this belief that I had to work, I had to make money. If I could make money, I could have a car and be independent, and then I could have freedom, which seemed to be what I believed freedom was. College was wonderful, but college started for me a journey in my life that I call looking for love in all the wrong places. It started kind of a pretty dark hole in here for a lot of secrets and a lot of shame and guilt. I came from a family of very conservative women. There was a legacy, you know, all women saved themselves for their husband. My mother was like that. My sister was like that. The grandmothers were like that. All the aunts were like that. And I guess I kind of broke the legacy in school. I felt a lot of shame about that. And but then, you know, I masked it with, oh, well, who, you know, I'm all spoiled now, so let's party. You know, who cares? I graduated. I went back to Houston, and I got my first job when all my friends were pretty much starting their careers, getting married, starting families. I was working, but I was still a party girl. You know, I worked hard, and I played hard. And I was introduced to a lot of drugs in college, but out of respect that this is an AA meeting, I'm trying not to go there. But I did my share of drugs. My preference in drugs was stimulants, cocaine and crystal meth. But I learned later on in my journey in recovery that I liked stimulants because it helped me drink more, because alcohol was my drug of choice. One of the girls at dinner tonight made me laugh when she said her drug of choice was more. And for me, I could relate. So, you know, fast forward, I'm working in Houston. I have a bank job. I decide that I want more money. And I also really liked jobs in bars and restaurants. And I got a job working at the Ramada Rama Room, whereby I met a girl. She was a dealer. She was also a waitress. And I kind of started running around with a really rough crowd. And it scared me. So I did my first geographic. I wanted to go back to the Hill Country, which was what I called my happy place. And I called up a guy that I had dated that was living in Austin, and I said, can I come live with you? And he said, sure. So I moved back to Austin, and I ended up marrying him. And shortly after I married him, we got a phone call. My father had been in a car accident, a very serious car accident, and was in the hospital. So I went home, and he died shortly thereafter. And my father was a practicing alcoholic. And, you know, I grew up in the classic dysfunctional family of alcoholism. You know, alcoholism is really a family disease, affects everybody. But I do remember that his death and the wreck was a mystery because there was no other vehicle involved. He was driving by himself. And there was a witness that saw him lost control of the vehicle, but it was a mystery. So after they did an investigation and an autopsy, they couldn't find anything wrong with him except the alcohol content in his blood. And the girl who worked for the pathologist was also the same girl who got the Boone's Farm Tickle Pink Strawberry Wine. She was my best friend. And I remember her coming over to the house that day, and she had the autopsy report. So the secret was out, and my family did not want to discuss it or hear about it. And I remember feeling so devastated. This was the worst thing that had ever happened to me, the death of my father. I loved my father so much. And I remember feeling so much pain and being around all these relatives and just thought I was going to die, you know. And in walks my friends with a case of beer. And it was like, oh, thank God. They're here. And it wasn't the friends, it was the beer. I knew I was going to be able to have a drink. And that's how I dealt with life. shortly after my father died, I got divorced. You know, I blamed my ex-husband for everything that went wrong in our marriage. We drank and used together. We were married 2 years. I was working again. I had my first arrest in Kima on the wharf there. It was a shipping area. And I conveniently forgot about this first arrest that I had until I got into the program, and then I remembered it. Public intoxication. I was falling down drunk. I couldn't drive. They put me in a, you know, Barney Fife two-cell jail. And I remember being so angry at the police for arresting me because, you know, I kept telling them that they put something in my drink. They put something in one of those 10 drinks. I know they did. And so, again, I did my second geographic. I was just reading the big book this last week, and I wanted to share something I hadn't read before. They said on geographics, this was in, I think, the Empty on the Inside, a story in the back. They said that, you know, for alcoholics, they should have on county lines and state lines signs when they do geographics that says, this state won't work either. I did my second geographic, and I moved out to California. And there was going to be, you know, I was going to get my act together. No more, I was going to get this drinking thing under control. I wasn't going to do any more drugs. And I wasn't going to keep looking for love in all the wrong places. And I started going to bars by myself. You know, California's beautiful. We live in paradise. I did have some friends up here from Texas. A lot of them were party friends from school. They had moved out here. But fast forward again, and in 2002, I got my first DUI. And, you know, I was a blackout drinker from early on. And all I can tell you is that one Saturday night, I was drinking heavily. I woke up still drunk, started watching a Charger football game. It was an early game, Kansas City. It was in the morning. And the next thing I remember is waking up on the bench in Las Colinas. I couldn't tell you how I got there or what happened. And, you know, again, there was this part of me in this sick ego that I had that it was like the rules didn't apply to me. You know, it was almost like, and I think a lot of it was still being under the influence, but I do remember telling them they couldn't put me in the cell, you know, after they moved me from one place to another. And I caused a scene in the jail, and so they just handcuffed me to a bench outside the cell. And that's where I sat for like 6 hours until I said, okay, do you unhandcuff me so I can go in the cell now? And, you know, but, you know, I got the paperwork when I got out of jail, and the address of the place of arrest was my home address. I had no clue what had happened. It was actually one building number over from the condominiums that I lived. And so I got this attorney, and he said, you know what? There's nothing in the police report. We're going to fight this. And I said, all right. So they're going to get me off so I don't have to do, you know, the rules don't apply. You know, I don't have to do all that stuff. And I went about my way. I still had no knowledge or memory of what happened. As much as I tried, I did not know. So finally he said, the police report said that a good Samaritan called 911. I guess they saw you in your vehicle, got concerned for your well-being, and they called the paramedics. And that's how the police and the paramedics came out. Well, apparently this good Samaritan wouldn't return the prosecutor's calls. And so finally, right before everything, I was going to get off, my attorney called me and says, well, I got some bad news. I said, what happened? He said, well, they subpoenaed your good Samaritan. They went to his house and got his testimony about what happened. I said, well, what happened? Finally, I was going to find out what happened. And he said, well, he and his wife went to leave their garage, and when they opened the garage, you were parked behind, blocking it. Apparently, I was so drunk, I didn't even know. I turned in the wrong driveway. So I had apparently tried to open a garage with my own garage door opener, but it wasn't my garage door, so I couldn't open it. And I must have sat there forever trying, and I finally gave out, and I just passed out with the car running behind, blocking my neighbor. The attorney said, guess what? You know, you're not getting off this DUI. So I went on the six-month program through the DUI school, and I convinced myself that the only reason that anybody gets a DUI, lots of people get them, and the only reason why I was drinking that heavily was because my mother was sick, and, you know, I didn't fail to take too much notice of the fact that my blood alcohol was 0.38. I took, you know, pride. I was kind of a, I'm kind of a big girl. I'm tall, and I had a very high tolerance to alcohol, but I used to just drink till I passed out. So, that was DUI number one, and it was pretty horrendous, and I just kept drinking the same way. And eventually, fast forward 2 years, I got my second DUI. Wasn't as dramatic. I do remember a little bit about it. And again, then I was put back into the DUI education and whatnot. So I really got introduced to AA with the nudge from the judge. The first DUI, I went to one AA meeting, Drunks Only, which at that time was in Mission Valley Hanley Hotel. And I remember I walked in, put my slip in the basket, and saw the number of people in this meeting and just panicked. Sat in the back and just had my head down and thought, you know, I didn't want to be here. And I remember leaving and this guy following me out, and he was very, very nice. And he said, so how much time do you have? And I looked at him and I said, I only spent one night in jail. I was so annoyed. What business if it was his how much time I spent in jail? I didn't get it. It was DUI number one. After the DUI education, I kind of got it. And then I was in the 18-month program on the second one. And my attorney said to me, he said, with your high BACs and the close proximity of the arrests and the fact that you're on probation, he said, you better do something and show that you're getting some help. So at that point, I thought, you know, I am worried about my drinking. I had tried to control my drinking for years, but, you know, I lived alone. I had occasionally had a roommate. It never worked out, usually because of my drinking. So I continued to work hard, drink hard. But by this time, my drinking had now progressed to the point where it was affecting my work. You know, I had this one job where it was ridiculous. You know, every time I kept calling in, you know, it was kind of like the dog ate my homework story, but it was like, oh, you know, my cat's sick. I had to take my cat to the vet. Or, you know, the dishwasher exploded and flooded the kitchen, and I had to clean it up. I would make out these outlandish stories, and I kind of became a joke around the office. And I remember when I was getting written up for the final time before they fired me, it was like, you know, you do a good job when you're here. But that was the problem. I was always late. I was, you know, I was never there and absent a lot. And so I got a job in Mission Valley. When I left that position, I got a job in Mission Valley, which, you know, I have to be honest, I worry about sharing it because I don't know if anybody in here knows where I work or is one of my customers. So my apologies, and I make amends to you now. But I got a job working in an office, and I'm all by myself. It's a satellite office. I do property management. And it was really the job that took me to the bottom because I didn't have to be accountable to anybody. I didn't, you know, I showed up late. I remember I was always out in the field, and much of the time, you know, I would be out in the field, which meant laying in bed, hungover, can't get up, talking on the phone, dealing with whatever business had to be taken care of at that time. And again, if there is anyone in here, my apologies that know me from work. I kept going down and spiraling down, but at this point, I had gone into an outpatient treatment program, and they had started teaching me about the disease, and I also started going to an AA meeting. This is when I started going to the huddle. I knew I had a drinking problem, but there was a part of me that still, my denial was so big, there was a part of me that just couldn't concede to my innermost self. I felt that there was somehow, some way, I was going to get a handle on this drinking thing. You know, I was raised in a family that said, you know, you put your mind to what you can do, anything you want to put your mind to. And you tell that to an alcoholic, and my parents used to say, can't never did nothing. That means, you know, that can't was in the vocabulary. You can do anything you set your mind to. And I just absolutely refused to submit and surrender to say that I was an alcoholic. So it was just kind of going through the motions. But I was in the rooms. See, I call my first and second DUIs God's loving 2x4, because I believe, I prayed, I needed help with my drinking, and God gave it to me every time. He answered my prayers. But so I was going to the huddle. I got about 2.5 months sober, 30-day chip, 60-day chip. I'd completed the treatment program that I was in. I'd learned a tremendous amount about the disease, and I was feeling so good. Physically, I felt good. I wasn't drinking. I started doing things that normal people do, like clean their house, bathe regularly. Seriously, I mean, things that you wouldn't, I mean, truly. Taking care of myself. I was feeling wonderful. And I had about 2.5 months in the program, and a friend of mine invited me up to Carlsbad, said she wanted, you know, want to go hang out on the beach with her. She lived in a beach house, and so I went up there. I took the train because of the DUI thing. I wasn't driving, although I did drive without a license for over a year. And she had some Coke. She said, well, it's not drinking. And you know, I just conveniently forgot that they told me in treatment, no mind-impairing substances whatsoever. So I spent a weekend with her snorting cocaine, and was so very proud of the fact that I didn't drink. And I remember taking the train home, and I got on that train, and I remember in my mind, it was like this crazy rhythmic statement over and over again. I want to drink, I want to drink, I want to drink, I want to drink. It was just like in rhythm to that train. And I was so proud of myself, because I got home and I didn't. The next day I didn't. A week went by and I didn't. I'm like, you know what? I got this thing lit, man. So I talked myself into, I know I can handle it. And I had a glass of wine. And that started the week of what I call my lost week. I tell you what, you guys, when they say the disease does push-ups, I mean, it scares me when I hear people have a lot of time and then go out. I had 2.5 months. But when I drank that last time that week, it was different. It felt different. The drunk was different. It was horrible. And I mean, I don't remember much about that week, except I was drinking around the clock. I was driving everywhere. I was going in and out of places. I had receipts in my purse from bars I didn't remember going to. It was horrible. And I had adopted 2 kitties, and those poor things, they were running around my house, shitting everywhere. I mean, it was horrible. And I woke up one Sunday morning, and I walked downstairs, and there was all these grocery bags all over the floor. And I thought, I had no idea where they came from. So I picked them up, and it was like toilet paper and cat food and paper towels, those 3 things. And I started having these flashbacks, you know. And the receipt said 4:20, 4:30 a.m. And what I had done was I drove in a blackout to the Ralph's grocery store, which is where I usually got my alcohol. I went in and just put a bottle of wine down. I loved wine, but I drank just about anything. But wine was my drug of choice, or alcohol choice. And I tried to buy wine, and they said, I'm sorry, ma'am, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. We don't sell wine till 6 a.m. And meanwhile, I was in a blackout. I'm sure I was stumbling around. So I got irritated. I had said a few choice words, and I walked out, and I went to the Longs in the same strip center. These were the two places that I would alternate when I bought my alcohol, many times multiple trips, even in one night. So I went to the Longs. I marched right in. I put a glass of a bottle of wine on the counter. But this is after knocking over a display of wine in the aisle. I remember seeing the manager. There was only me, the clerk, and the manager. Kind of, it was just, he was running down the aisle with his hands up in the air. They said, "No, ma'am, we don't, you know, serve, we don't sell wine till 6 a.m. And then they had said they were going to call the police. I then went back to the Ralphs, and I guess I thought I was going to outsmart them. And I bought all these groceries, the toilet paper, the paper towels, and the cat food, and then snuck a bottle of wine in there, thinking, you know, I'm going to... Only a falling-down drunk would think that they could get away with that, you know? And it was pretty bad. I had a reputation at the Ralph's grocery store. I've actually met and run into a girl that used to be one of the checkers that I used to sell my wine to. She's one of us. And she has told me some stories about myself. Pretty embarrassing. So anyway, I don't know how I managed to get home. My attorney had told me that if I got a third DUI, it was do not pass go, do not collect $100, you're going straight to jail, and for a minimum of 6 months, based on my case. And there was something, though, that had happened. I had been in the AA meetings. I had listened enough to know that at that point I was done. And there was this moment where I knew that I was done. I was scared to death, scared sober. I called up the woman I met at the treatment center. I went back to the aftercare program that I refused to go. I told her that I had relapsed, and she sat with me in an office for 4 hours while I cried my heart out. And she said, "Okay, you're going to sign a contract. This is it. You're going to 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, meeting every day. I want you to call me every morning at 10 a.m. You better have a sponsor in a week." I mean, she just laid it all out for me. And that woman saved my life. I call her my first earth angel. And so I went back to the huddle. And in that walk of shame, I announced myself as a newcomer. And all the people in that room knew. I just remember the faces in that meeting that day so clearly. I remember where I sat, and I remember the love and the acceptance of the people in that room. And you know, that was the beginning for me. You know, I think that so much we think about our bottoms as being these horrible stories, and in many ways they are, with the wreckage and whatever we're doing and what we do to ourselves. But for me, I know that it was the beginning of a new life. You know, I learned so many good things in that meeting, and I really didn't start venturing out to other meetings, although I did get hooked up with some women. I did get a sponsor. But, you know, in my mind, I thought, I just don't have to drink. And I already believe in God. So, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And I just didn't take heed to the, well, you need to work the steps part. So my first year, I pretty much white-knuckled it. Very close calls a few times. I just didn't want to change anything about my life. Went to the French Quarter once. And wanted to hear jazz, and you know, didn't drink. I invited all my drinking friends to my house one Christmas that year, and told them, "I'm fine, I'm fine, everything's fine. I just don't drink anymore. But I'll make you a drink. What would you like? You know, I love to entertain. I love to cook, and you know, these people. And I did. I felt fine. I didn't feel like I needed a drink, but I felt like I needed to show them, you know, that I was okay. And the last person walked out that night, and I remember the door shut, and it was like a switch. I wanted to drink, and I was surrounded by alcohol. So I called this woman, who I never called, who was my sponsor at that time, and she told me to turn to page 63 in the big book. I poured all the alcohol out, and I realized that I had not done step three. I had not trusted the process of AA and the 12 steps, and that I needed to, for the first time, take action. So I made that decision, and I made a commitment, and I started trying to work the steps. How am I doing? I don't even know how much. Am I doing okay? 10 minutes? The first sponsor I had, I made her sit with me in a restaurant for 5 hours while I did my fifth step, actually, for her. But my first inventory was all about everybody I was mad at, everybody that I was resentful towards, all the fears I had, and very little about my part. But it was the best I could do at the time. And I kind of remember the first go-around with the steps that I just kind of immediately then jumped to the amends. 6 and 7, it was like, okay, I read it. Okay, say the prayer. Okay, now I'm into the amends. Because the inventory and the amends were, at that time for me, very daunting. I had a lot of wreckage and a lot of people to make amends to. But I made my amends as best as I could. And, you know, this is the beautiful part of this program, and when they say more will be revealed. At that point in my life, I didn't have any amends to make to my ex-husband because I had forgiven him for all he had done. That was my first, you know, year and a half in the program. But I've done my inventory since then, and in the second year, I've thought, well, maybe I had something to do with that marriage. And by the third year, it was like, oh, my God, this marriage was completely my fault. And I started, you know, it was just as if I started learning more about myself. And I recognize that I cannot blame anybody else. I'm powerless over anything they do. And this was a man who had loved me unconditionally. And I did not. I did not ever accept him as he was. I wanted him to change and be what I wanted him to be. You know, no one knows where he is. I'm trying now to make my amends, and even his parents, I guess they don't know where he is, but I'm trying, and I just keep turning it over, and I hope that one day I may get a chance to make an amends to him if he crosses my path. But, you know, a lot of my amends, I had one good friend that I had been a roommate to that I created a lot of wreckage, and she was going to be one of the hard ones. And I remember her saying to me, the best thing you could do for me is a living amends and stay sober. And so, you know, I now have another sponsor that I got, my sponsor that I have now. She's here tonight. Her name is Anne Marie. And I feel like the luckiest girl in the world to have this woman as my sponsor. I heard her in the PB Alano Club, and I was about 3 years sober, and I remember just bawling while she was talking. She hit so many nerves. She hit that black place, that guilt and shame of that path of mine, looking for love in all the wrong places journey of my life. And I remember one gentleman that goes through the huddle was behind me, and he saw me sobbing, and he pushed me, and he goes, go talk to her. And I'm like, no. You know, I had a lot of secrets that I was taking to the grave. And but I went up to her, and I just remember I probably scared her to death because I said, ah, and I just grabbed her and hugged her and was sobbing, and she agreed to meet me and talk to me. And she took me through the steps, and I feel like I did the steps for real with Anne Marie. I did my first sexual inventory. God, I didn't keep her for 5 hours, but it seemed like it took a long time. And I remember being so afraid to trust her and share some things that I was going to take to the grave. And she knew I was frightened, and I remember her just so gently just talking about her own life. And it was something she said that I just knew, it just opened a door for me to drop the rock. So I told her. And there was this long pause, and then we just burst out laughing, just hysterically. What a release. What a release. I'll never forget that. And, you know, I guess I just, I've learned so many things in the program, and I try to pass on what was told to me. And I love working the steps with women. There are some women here that I work the steps with that I just love so much, and I'm so grateful that they're in my life. Because when I hear their story, I learn more about myself. They teach me about who I am. My sponsor helps me learn more about who I am. You know, I find that in AA, I never really knew what was good for me. And even now, if I think I know what's good for me, I need to go to a meeting and just listen. Because I have proved it time and time again that I don't know what's good for me. And I need to listen to the guidance and the wisdom of the people in AA. The God that I grew up with, I had this vision that there was this God that sat on this big throne, this long beard, and I was this good church girl when I was growing up, and I felt that if I went to God and the pearly gates, there would be St. Peter. And I just had this fantasy vision that they would open the scroll and say, Patty Carroll's here, and oh my, you've been a very bad girl. That's not the God, or my higher power I like to call God. That's not the God and the higher power that I believe in today. The God that I believe in today is one that is of nothing but unconditional love and acceptance and forgiveness. And I learned to find that higher power by all the people in all the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, by listening to them share their experience and their strength and their hope. So God's loving 2x4 that brought me into the rooms, God, I know, has always been with me. But it was the people in AA that brought me back to God. And so I just keep trying to keep showing up. You know, I totally relate to, I have lots of fears still. I don't know what's in store for me. And I keep just trying to take the next indicated step. And I try to detach from the results, which is so hard. I don't really know what God's will is for me. I believe that He wants me to be sober. I know in my heart that's the truth. But I realize that I have this instant forgetter chip in my head. No matter how many meetings I go to or how much I try to work this program, I go out and I forget. And that's this great awareness that AA has given me. You know, you can't get away with anything anymore when you're in AA. I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And my sponsor, Anne-Marie, taught me to get on my knees every morning. I have to admit, I got on my knees in the bathroom back in the back before this because it was recommended to me. It brought back some not so fond memories of being on my knees in the bathroom. But I did it. I did it, and I think I should close, huh? There's a man that's an old timer in one of our, in my home group at the Huddle, and he gave me this card, and I keep it in my wallet. And I love what it says. It says, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God. and God in him. And I am so grateful. For Alcoholics Anonymous and the life I have now. I still dance. I still love to party, but I do it sober. And, I see God in so many places in my life, in the beach, in nature, my cat's eyes, but I feel the presence of God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't thank you guys enough for being here tonight and for your patience and listening to my story. Thank you, Larry and Randy, for asking me here. And thank you for letting me be of service. Yeah. Love you all.